So that's Luke chapter 7. I'm going to read the first 17 verses. After he had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. Soon afterward, he went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a great crowd followed him. As he drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a considerable crowd from the town was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Then he came up and touched the bier, and the bearers stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak. And Jesus gave him to his mother. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks, Matt.
Let me add my welcome this evening. There's a number of people here that I have never met before, so I'm great to see you here. And just to add, there's info about the church. As Josh said, through those foyer doors on my right, as you go out the doors, I suppose, there is info. But if you walk through and then on the left, there's a table with all the different ministries of the church and some info there. So please feel free to take them. We generally don't charge. Well, free time. Isn't free time just an amazing thing? I googled it the other night, and it turns out free time's that thing I had 12 years ago when I studied an arts degree, but it's been about 10 years since I've had it. And so let me ask you, what do you do with your free time? If you're a student, perhaps you have lots of it, so there's lots of answers that you might give. At this point in my life with a young family, I have precious little free time, and the little free time that I have, I generally spend watching with my wife on a Friday night. That's usually our date night. We watch detective shows, detective movies, whodunits, and we love competing, trying to work out who the murderer is first. That's kind of what you do, and we're both competitive. And I don't want to kind of blow my own trumpet here, but I dominated for 9 years out of the 12. Absolutely dominated. 9 times out of 10, it would be me that gets it first. And if she got it first, dumb luck. Definitely dumb luck. Well, that's changed in the last 12 months. I don't know if she's read a book about it or taken up studying detective work on the side. But now we're kind of 50-50. It's anyone's guess who's going to sleuth it right, get the killer first. But there's a negative about that type of fiction, that type of TV show or movie, and that is with a whodunit, it's got an expiry date. You watch it once, and that's it. You work out who killed the person, and it's really not worth watching again. A good comedy you can watch 2 or 3 times, a good drama likewise. But with a whodunit, it lacks the gloss and the intrigue because, well, you know the twists and turns. You know, in the end, everything that happens. And so you end up being just not all that surprised and therefore not all that interested watching it a second time. Where am I going with this? Hear me out here. I think a parallel can be drawn, maybe it's kind of a distant one, between that not being able to watch the whodunit a second time and Jesus. Because Jesus acts like he's already watched his life once and he's living through a rerun. He knows where everyone's going. He knows what everyone's saying, certainly what everyone's thinking. And from the early days of his ministry, he knows he's going to the cross, he's dying, and he's being raised again. And because of that, Jesus is seldom surprised. He seldom is taken aback or astonished. He seems to just take everything that comes at him as if he knew already. But there are two exceptions, as far as I can see. Two exceptions where Jesus does seem to be genuinely astonished. He seems to be taken aback. And one of them is our scene tonight, which is our focus. Chapter 7, verse 9. Have a look. We're looking at the centurion tonight. 7:9. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, the centurion, and turning to the crowd that followed him, said, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." And so the question on the agenda this evening is, what was so marvelous about that centurion's faith? What about it took Jesus, or if not by surprise, certainly it staggered him? And I want to say there are two aspects to a marvelous faith, and we'll get onto them a little later. But to do so, we're going to look at the passage. So have a look at 7 verse 1. The scene is set here. After he had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, and we'll stop just there. And what are these sayings? Well, we looked at some of them last week, and it's the well-known Sermon on the Mount. And a big theme, and you might remember because we looked at it 18 months ago, a big theme on the Sermon on the Mount is the fact that the kingdom that Jesus is bringing in, the kingdom of God, is one that seems inside out, upside down. It's the lost, the lonely, the poor, the outsider that are accepted into God's kingdom, which ran against the grain of expectation, hence the name of the series, Unexpected Kingdom, because people assumed it would be the wealthy, the religious, the righteous that would get in. But in 6, it's very clear that the tables are being turned. It's blessed are the poor, blessed are those that mourn, and so on and so forth. And then in chapter 7, the upside down nature of this kingdom is kind of played out before our eyes in reality. And we begin with this guy, the centurion, and his great faith. And a centurion, let me tell you, is exactly the opposite person that a Jew of Jesus' day would think would get into the kingdom. Because a centurion was a living, breathing symbol of Roman hostility, Roman paganism, Roman oppression. As a Jew walked around their country, they would be reminded at every outpost, every soldier, every centurion, that in fact they were conquered by a foreign power, and a pagan one at that. And yet in this scene, we come across a centurion who has greater faith than anyone in all of God's people, Israel. And so then we go to the next scene, and the next scene is about a widow. Again, someone considered by most to be cursed, not blessed, and not only that, but she has no living direct relative. She loses her son in that scene. And what happens? Well, Jesus comes with his kingdom and brings her son back to life, showing this great reversal. And then the chapter ends with a prostitute. And it kind of doesn't matter where you draw your square box around your kingdom and what religion you're in. No religion has a prostitute squarely in the middle of the kingdom. And yet she's the one that Jesus ends up praising, forgiving her sins, showing us that she is one of those kingdom people. So chapter 7 is like a worked example of chapter 6, the principles borne out in reality. Okay, so that's the chapter at a glance. Let's zoom back to verse 1. So Jesus says some stuff and then he heads to Capernaum. And Capernaum is a name that pops up a lot in the Gospels because that was Jesus' home base in this particular time of his ministry in Galilee. So he's in and out of Capernaum a lot. But this is a bit different because in this one he receives an envoy from the already mentioned centurion. And we learn immediately why the centurion has sent an envoy. Now, a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. So we have a valuable servant on the left, and we have his desperate master on the right. A master that's so desperate that he's willing to approach a fabled, wandering Jewish preacher and miracle worker and plead for his healing powers. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him the elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. Now, not yet, but we are going to focus on those two characteristics of his faith that are marvelous. But it's worth pointing out here that his faith starts at the same point that your and my faith does, on hearing about Jesus. Look at the text again. When the centurion heard about Jesus. Because it is true, when kind of comparing your faith with the faith of the people in the Bible, there's often a cop-out, isn't there? There's often an out clause. Well, of course they have great faith in Jesus. They shared a tent with him. They saw Jesus calm a storm. They saw him walk on water. They saw him make five loaves into thousands. Paul saw the living, resurrected Lord Jesus. Of course they have faith. But that's not what's going on here, right? There's no out clause with this guy. He merely hears about Jesus. No first-hand experience. He starts where we start. And so hearing about Jesus, it leads him to send an envoy to ask for his help. And did you notice it's a Jewish envoy, elders of the Jews. And that makes a bit of sense. He's probably thinking, Jewish preacher, healer guy. I have some Jews that like me. I'll send them along. But it is a bit weird. Because as I noted earlier, centurions would not have been loved by Jews, certainly not the elders of the Jews. They don't like outsiders to begin with, and certainly not hostile, oppressive outsiders. So why were the elders of the Jews being willing to be at the beck and call of the centurion? Well, it's no mystery, it's no whodunit. The next verse, verse 4. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, he is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built our synagogue. So why do these guys, why do the elders of the Jews like this guy? Well, it probably comes down eventually to the dollar bills. He's the one that has the cashola to get the synagogue built, and he did. And so that's earned him the right to have an envoy of the Jewish elders. And so then we have Jesus, doesn't say anything, he obviously accepts their entreaty, and he goes along with them. But I want you to kind of focus now, look at the words of these elders for a moment. It's no doubt they relay the centurion's message, they no doubt say, help, help, please come and heal this great centurion's servant. But in trying to kind of ensure that Jesus comes along, in order to kind of plead with him and to almost twist his arm maybe, they appeal to three things. One, they appeal to the centurion's worth. He is worthy to have you do this for him. Two, they appeal to Jesus' kind of patriotism or his nationalism. Four, the centurion, he loves our nation. And then three, they appeal to his wealth, or at least his generosity. And he is the one who built us our synagogue. And that kind of seems reasonable, I suppose, from the outside. They're things that would twist the average person's arm, I think. But an actual point of fact, these three things amount, and it's going to sound like a big claim, but work with me here, amount to, I think, a fundamental misunderstanding of A, who Jesus is, and B, how God works. Because what are they? They boil down to three ways of trying to demonstrate why this man has earned something from Jesus. Jesus, you need to do this for him because he's a great bloke. You need to help him because, you know what, unlike the other centurions, he's on our side politically. You owe him because he's rich, he's generous, and he's kind of religious to boot. He built our synagogue. And this approach here, coming to Jesus, asking something of him based on what we deserve because we've earned it, well, that didn't stop 2,000 years ago in Palestine, did it? In fact, we encounter it pretty much every day. And let me give you my most vivid encounter of presuming Jesus owes us something. It happened 3.5-4 years ago now. So I was out, I'll ignore that dropping, out having a curry with one of my mates and his friend. It was actually a terrible curry. I'd tell you the place, but then that would be defamatory, so I won't. It's in Leaderville. If you're going for a curry in Leaderville, come and speak to me and I'll recommend not going to this one. Anyway, went there. It was overpriced. I'm back on track, Dodd. And he brought his friend along called Tom, who was a militant atheist, a guy who's really, really not into God existing at all. And as is the kind of case, if you've engaged with these people, they love talking about God. They're more evangelistic than me. They just like talking about the non-existence of God. But this guy didn't. This guy, he fooled me. Because he started to act as if God did exist, that Jesus exists. And not only that Jesus existed, but that Jesus owed him, that is Tom. And it came about with an innocent enough question. I said, Tom, how's work going? And he said, really, really positive. His current job was going great. He'd been there 3 months and he was just kicking goals. It was delightful. And so I said, oh, okay, and where were you before that? Massive mistake. He proceeds on, I don't know, 2-3 minute tirade on his former place of employment. A tirade that if I repeated it here and now, I would have to kind of go beep, 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 beep. In fact, it would sound like a flatlined heart monitor. Such was the swearing. And it ended with this note, and it's not a verbatim quote, it was a while ago, but something like this. God owes me big time. That was because his previous job was terrible. And this new job he is finally paying me back in. And now a number of things popped into my head. Three, to name three of them. One, impressed how many swear words you could fit into a sentence. Generally didn't know that was possible. Two, I thought, you don't even believe in God, Tom. What's going on? And three, and significantly for now, if there is a God, Tom, I thought, even if you don't know much about him, surely just the nature of him being God, you've kind of got to concede that he doesn't owe you anything. That is, if the God that we're talking about, and I assume we are, creator of time and space, upholds the universe by the power of his word. Tom, what on earth could he possibly owe you? He gives you every experience of life. He gives you the breath in your lungs, your very heartbeat. Every second is from his hands. What on earth have you, Tom, done, Tom, that might possibly make God be your debtor? And of course, it's easy to think like that. It's easy to dismiss Tom, right? But he's only saying out loud what we think in our heads. God, how on earth could you possibly do this to me? Insert unfavorable event. It's as if we think we deserve a life without challenges. Our Thursday night Bible studies, our community service has earned from God a free ticket to comfort. And if that comfort is disrupted, then God is on the hook. Or think, and I've said this before, but it's important, I think. Think about the mental calculation you do to work out when you pray. You've got to make sure if you pray for a big thing that it's a good day. You've got to work out that you make sure you've got the Jesus dollars, the brownie points. Enough Christian currency to purchase your blessing. But if you've yelled at the kids and kicked the dog, well, we'll wait tomorrow. God will forget about today. And then I'll earn the right to get that blessing. See, Jewish elders or Tom or us, we have a tendency to act like we're worth something and we're worth enough so that God would owe us. And we see this most crystally clearly, I think, at least at a cultural level, when it comes to conversations about heaven and the afterlife. That classic conversation, you know, if you were to die today, this is evangelism explosion, if you know the tool. If you were to die today and appear before God, on what basis should you appeal to in order to get into heaven? And if you've done it, 99.9% of people, I'm better than them. It's because I'm a good guy. When I rock up to those pearly gates, St. Pete's going to let me in knowing I'm a good un. I'm certainly better than the average Australian. And what's that saying? That's effectively saying, I'm worth it. I could prove my worth to God if placed before him on judgment day. It's how every religion except for Christianity works, as far as I can tell. And it's how every person except the Christian works. And it's a faith, right? It is a faith. It's a faith, A, that that's how God works. And B, it's a faith that you're good enough to get in. But it's precisely the opposite of a biblical faith, a Christian faith. Because a Christian faith doesn't try and work out our current standing before God based upon what we can bring into his presence that is deserving. 180 degrees the opposite. It humbly recognizes that standing before the presence of an almighty and a holy God, there is absolutely nothing we can drag in of any worth on our own. And that's what's happening in the passage. Have a look at the centurion in verse 6. And Jesus went with them, that's the cohort of elders. And when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends. So obviously the centurion can either see Jesus at a distance, or he's been given a heads up that Jesus is coming in. And so he sends his friends out there. And they relay probably a message closer to what the centurion wanted. It certainly doesn't have the kind of the playmaking that the elders have. And it says this, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof." You notice that? That's a direct contradiction of the words of the Jewish elders. They say, "He is worthy of you to do this to him." And the centurion, "I am not worthy for you, not even for the healing, but not even worthy for you to come into my house under my roof." You see, the centurion, he's worked something out. He's heard of Jesus, he's heard of his mighty deeds and his teaching, and with the eyes of faith, has seen that Jesus is a man like no other. The elders presumed to prove Jesus' obligation. And we learn here that he refused, because you've got to wonder, why are there two envoys? Well, why doesn't he come in person? Well, maybe we thought it's because he's too important, or because he's looking after the sick person. No, it's because, well, he doesn't presume himself significant or important enough to come to Jesus. Verse 7, "Therefore I did not presume to come to you." And so coming back to our kind of characteristics of marvelous faith, characteristic one, marvelous faith, the faith of the centurion is a faith that hears the words of Jesus and recognizes in him a significance and authority that mean he is no man's debtor. True, faith doesn't strut into God's presence and presume to demand things. It bows down in God's presence, knowing there is nothing we can bring of our own worth. Let me try and illustrate this. I think a test of true faith works a bit like a monkey intelligence test. Work with me here. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but what they do is they have like a Perspex or a glass box. And inside the glass box, they place an apple or a Rubik's Cube or an iPhone or whatever. And then they put a hole kind of enough diameter for a monkey to kind of get a enclosed hand through. And what does the monkey or the ape do when it gets its hand in? Well, it grabs, say, an apple. And what does it do? Well, it doesn't just want to hold an apple. It wants to go nom, nom, nom. So how does it nom, nom, nom? Well, it gets the apple out. Oh, wait a minute. No. No, I don't. And I'm going to do this for 2 hours. And they do. They just add noise. You go like this, go like this, go like this. At least the clever apes work it out, but most don't. And the point is, of course, is that you can't have anything in your hand and take it out. That's not how it works. And true faith has the same test. Because if you try and carry anything in your hands into God's presence on the judgment day, if you try and bring anything with you, proving yourself to God, then you can't get in. You can't get through. It's only the one that carries nothing, that clings only, well, you can carry a cross, I suppose. You cling to the cross of Jesus. That's the thing that you can hold going in, but nothing else. So our first point, a marvelous faith recognizes God owes us nothing. All we can do is humbly approach him and ask. Okay, so you waited a long time for point one. I'm going to give you straight up point two so you don't need to wait as long. And point two is this. A marvelous faith actually believes. A marvelous faith actually believes. What do I mean? Back to the story. "But say the word," end of 7, "and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it." Why does the centurion ask for Jesus' help for his healing? Because he believes Jesus can do it. In fact, it's a significant thing because at this point in Jesus' ministry, he'd never healed like this. He'd never healed over distance, you could call it. And yet he'd obviously heard Jesus' words, heard about what he'd done, and then in faith steps out and says, "No, if Jesus is like that, he can certainly do this for me from a distance." And I think that's why, that's the crucial bit, or a significant part of why Jesus says, "I tell you, not even in Israel I found such faith." Because he's heard of Jesus, he believes in his authority. So coming back to our point. Well, obviously it's almost a tautology to say that true faith believes, right? Or faith believes. I mean, what is faith if not belief? They're synonymous. But here's my play. I think some of us, maybe some of us here tonight, have a faith in Jesus, but not a living belief. A faith in Jesus, but not a living belief. What do I mean? Well, there are people that attend church services and Bible studies and church busy bees, even help out in soup kitchens. And they earnestly believe that Jesus was a real historical figure. They believe that Jesus really healed people. They believe that Jesus really physically, bodily died on a cross and then physically, bodily rose again on the third day. And academically, they acknowledge Jesus' present authority. Biblically, they uphold the truth that God listens to all prayers of believers. And theologically, they acknowledge that Jesus can do all things, including healing people miraculously. But in reality, they don't believe that Jesus has any real present authority in their lives. They don't believe that Jesus really, really answers prayers. They don't think that he would actually, you know, heal a real person today. So many have a form of faith, but they don't genuinely believe. And this is often revealed. If you want to test to see whether this is you, it's often revealed in our thoughts and in our expectations. So many of us, when we see people who are stuck in their sin, spiritually dead, so far from God, we might see them down an alley with a needle in their arm or on the footpath in the city, clearly drunk out of their brains. Or in our own house across the table or on our screens in a Facebook thread. People stubbornly refusing to give Jesus a hearing. Refusing to believe that Jesus is even an option. And we think, I mean, are they really worth praying for? Could God? Maybe God could save them. Would God? Oh, wouldn't have thought so. Or our family members, our brothers and sisters, mum and dad, so kind of unashamedly living for money, for prestige, for wealth, for power, for sex, and think, oh, God, God's not going to save Tim. He's just not. And when we do that, and come on, we do that from time to time, we expose that we don't actually believe that Jesus has supreme authority. We don't believe him to be the man that he says he is, the man the centurion thought he was. And it's significant, I think. I think it's significant that the Greek word for heal is almost identical to the Greek word for save. And when we see the centurion's faith in Jesus' power to save his sick servant, we admire it. But we often fail to see the relevance for our own lives. Jesus might have saved miraculously back then, but odds are he won't do it now. Yes, we have a historic faith, but do we have a living belief? Let me give you a final diagnostic to work out the liveliness of your faith. You often see the opposite, a kind of deadness. In prayers that are kind of vague and wishy-washy, prayers that are really brief and mechanical, prayers where you don't bother being precise about anything. We don't bother kind of pouring our lifeblood and our heart into it because we don't believe God actually answers, that he actually saves like that anymore. And for those people, prayer feels like a one-way conversation with a distant and possibly imaginary friend. Not talking to the God that lives and reigns. That those prayers aren't the overflow of a heart that hears Christ's words and actually believes them. They're the empty words of someone who thinks Christ could, but most likely won't do anything. And it's certainly not the faith of the centurion here, who asks Jesus fully confident that he has the power and authority to save. All right, let's gather it up now. Let's gather it up into a question. What are the qualities of the centurion's marvelous faith? Or rather, what are the steps to attain that type of faith? Well, step one, come humbly acknowledge who you are before an almighty God. Nothing but empty hands you offer on a bended knee. Only to Christ's worth, not your own, do you cling. And two, believe, like really, really genuinely believe that Jesus is the guy that he says he is. That he is mighty to save, mighty on his throne. In short, say Jesus is Lord and live and pray like you genuinely mean it. That is a marvelous faith of someone who genuinely believes. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we come before you tonight, knowing that you are an almighty, all-powerful, all-loving, all-merciful God, and we are but lowly, sinful creatures. And yet you accept us. You accept us because of your love for us. You accept us because of what you did in Jesus. And I pray that you might help us remember to only cling to that. Help us not to be prideful. Help us not to be presumptuous. Help us not to think we can demand or assume anything from you. And certainly help us to believe in your power to save. Help us look at our friends, our family, our world, and to know that you are a God in authority. You are a God who can and often does. And to see in our own lives how you called us to yourself. In Jesus' holy name. Amen.